hospital has been negatively affected so that we have no way but to increase the charge of our services, and this constitutes an additional burden on Yemenis, especially amid the war and siege.
A Sabaeen maternal hospital in Yemen's capital Sana'a used to have 45,000 liters of diesel each month as a grant from the World Health Organization. However, the world body, the hospital said, has stopped its fuel grant due to what it says, financial problems.
We are Sabaeen Hospital in Sana'a. It is the referral hospital for maternity and the childhood disease. We are before we received oil from the WHO. During 2021, the amount of the oil received to the hospital is become decreased to the fourth the amount already we receive it. It is big catastrophe. It will lead to the death of the many child and woman, especially that admitted in the ICU, in the nursery, and the OT. Here in the hospital, we decrease most of our services to decrease the use of the electricity.
Earlier, Yemen's petroleum company said only three oil ships were allowed to arrive at Hudaydah port since the beginning of 2021, covering only 3% of what is required to fulfill the basic needs of Yemenis. The Saudi war and the blockade have led Yemen to the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Yemen's healthcare system is on the verge of collapse as a result of the Islamic Saudi war and the blockade. Yemen has also blamed the United Nations for their suffering, saying the world body should take real measures against the continuous Saudi violations of their rights. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
French President Macron announced recently that the Operation Barkhane in the Sahel region, especially in Mali, will be reshaped before the end of the year. Barkhane is a French military operation that started in 2014 in five Sahel countries: Mauritania, Niger, Burkina Faso, Chad and Mali, officially to fight against Al-Qaeda and Daesh-affiliated groups. In the beginning, French officials considered it as a success, but 7 years later, they admit that they have failed. Macron blames the Sahel states for the failure.
We cannot secure regions sliding back into lawlessness because the states decide not to take their responsibilities. That's impossible.
But are the Sahel states the only ones to blame? Is the stalemate in Mali not the result of the failure of French neocolonial policy in the region? Fact is that years after the French military intervention began, Mali is today divided in two, with the Malian state very little present in the north, where radical rebel groups control large parts of the country. So why did France intervene?
France has decided to intervene in the Sahel and in Mali to preserve its influence in the region. The French diplomacy was convinced that the status of France in the UN Security Council depended from the support of the Sahel countries. It guaranteed France of almost 30 extra votes in the UN General Assembly in support of its diplomacy.
But now France is getting bogged down in Mali, titles the monthly newspaper Le Monde Diplomatique. That's why France reshapes its military presence. 2,500 soldiers instead of 5,000. The new operation is called Takuba. Eventually, other European countries may join the French, but they are reluctant. Nobody wants to be humiliated as the USA have recently been in Afghanistan. The French neocolonial policy in the region is not anymore what it was. The central command of the Takuba task force will now be in Niger instead of Mali. That's not a coincidence. Niger has important uranium mines essential to feed the nuclear power plants in France. The Barkhane operation in Mali is coming to its end, but in fact it will continue under another name and by other means with the same hidden goal: to protect the economic interests of France in the region. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
NATO has just concluded its 17th annual arms control conference with harsh criticism directed towards authorities in Moscow, Beijing, Pyongyang and Tehran. NATO, led by the United States, continues to spend billions on military hardware, but clearly does not like it when nations outside the alliance develop their own defense capabilities.
There are also other players fielding nuclear weapons and advanced missile systems. North Korea and Iran, for example, are blatantly ignoring or breaking the global rules.
Iran has always stressed its nuclear program is purely peaceful. In fact, Tehran did all in its power to reassure the international community by signing up to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2015. It was the United States under Donald Trump that illegally withdrew from that nuclear accord. Stoltenberg failed to mention this once during his speech. In any case, experts say NATO is not in a position to point the finger. There are significant divisions within the 30-nation alliance. Its credibility is currently at rock bottom, critics argue, following its 20-year-long mission in Afghanistan.
The European member states of NATO will need to come up with real arguments to demonstrate that NATO makes values. You need to demonstrate the return on investment.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, concluded his address to the Arms Control Conference with these words.
You can count on NATO's commitment to security and stability.
That statement will likely cut to the bone for any Afghan citizen able to hear it. Anti-war campaigners say the destruction NATO countries brought to Afghanistan during the past two decades cannot be put into words. And now those Afghan civilians who somehow managed to survive have no idea what the future holds. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security Jabal prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Jabal prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with the Israeli occupation persists both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Voices of dissent outside Europe's biggest weapons fair, euphemistically called Defense and Security Equipment International, DSEI. More than 37,000 delegates descending on the British capital this year for a close encounter of the military kind, with more than 1,700 companies and dozens of governments here to buy or sell. Some are offering surveillance equipment, other manufacturers marketing all manner of lethal hardware. Among them, those who profited immensely from the so-called war on terror. The UK claims that it's leading the way in ethical arms sales.
We have a procedure that follows the consolidated criteria that is very clear around humanitarian law. We have in place a rigorous and robust process.
That is a claim dismissed by groups such as Stop the Arms Fair. They say by hosting the weapons show, Britain is perpetuating conflict and putting profit before human lives.
This arms fair wouldn't happen without the UK's support, the government's support. The defence and security exports team of the government makes sure that this arms fair happens. They know that human rights abusing countries are coming here to buy weapons that are made by UK companies and also foreign companies that we host in our country.
Campaigners also point out that several countries specifically invited here, such as the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain, are on the UK government's human rights watch list.
The fact that we're hosting such hideous weaponry and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
In recent years, short of 60% of British arms exports have gone to the Middle East, accounting for billions of dollars in sales. Most of that business has gone to Saudi Arabia, which, according to many rights groups, has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians in indiscriminate airstrikes in Yemen.
Since 2015, the UK government has approved hundreds of arms export licenses to Saudi Arabia, worth more than $9 billion. Of that figure, nearly $2 billion came between July and September last year, after a court here rejected a legal challenge to ban weapon sales to the kingdom, a move slammed by critics as immoral.
The UK also sells record amounts of arms to Israel, lending support to Tel Aviv's militarized repression of Palestinians. Campaigners in Britain's political opposition are calling for an immediate change in government policy. But while they point out a shift in public opinion in recent years, the arms fair and the multi-billion dollar worldwide industry that drives it shows every sign of growing. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi,
sir. Hi, kitty. Good morning. Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Lebanon has announced the formation of a new government in an attempt to put an end to the country's 13-month political deadlock. Prime Minister Najib Mirati's list of ministers, which consists of 24 members, includes many technocrats. Lebanon has been headed by a caretaker government since Prime Minister Hassan Diab resigned in the wake of the catastrophic Beirut port explosion in August 2020, which killed over 200 people. Since then, Lebanese political groups had failed to resolve their differences. Fuel shortages in Lebanon have forced businesses and government offices to close, threatening to cause blackouts at hospitals and halt transportation. The crisis has been exacerbated by U.S. sanctions as well as foreign intervention in the Arab nation's domestic affairs. First joining us on tonight's program, we have our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who's with us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mariam, if you're with us, tell us about the significance of the political developments in Lebanon right now.
Well, it is very important. However, it is not the only step that should be taken. This is just the first step ahead in the 1,000 miles that we need to take in order for us to resolve the crisis in Lebanon. Of course, this government on its own cannot resolve the crisis. We heard also from the European Union stressing to the new government that they know their first duty, which is the long overdue reforms that need to be taken by the Lebanese government in in order to deserve, as they say, new funds that are coming in. Of course, that would be perhaps the first reaction from foreign sides. We also have congratulations from other countries. However, they're all eyeing this government specifically. We did not see, of course, people very much with high hopes, because what they want to see is that they can find and provide for their families on a daily basis, that the price of the dollar is not as high as it reached in the last few months. They want to be able to take their kids to school. They want to be able to provide medication for the ill. So these are just basic needs that we're looking at, in addition to the fuel crisis, with what's happening in hospitals and schools that are also, of course, threatened not opening. So these are some of the things that Prime Minister Najib Mikati mentioned himself, and he said that, "I will knock on all doors. I will not leave a stone unturned without trying to, of course, doing my best in order to help resolve the crisis with the team that he has put together in accordance with, of course, President Michel Aoun." Of course, although these are newcomers, they're not politicized. They don't belong directly to political groups. However, they were endorsed by different political factions because it is necessary to have that endorsement in order to ensure that there will be confidence for the government so the government can do its job. We will be seeing perhaps in the next week a meeting by the parliament to study the cabinet manifesto and to see if they can provide a vote of confidence for this cabinet in what time it has left in order for it to be able to do something to uplift this crisis, or at least put in a salvation plan, if we may say.
All right, thanks a lot. Mariam Saleh joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Let's take a look at the guests that we have for tonight's show. Journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas is joining us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Mr. Magni in Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Elijah, what are some of the immediate challenges for the new government in Lebanon?
Hello, and thank you for having me. I think Miriam summarized very well the situation in Lebanon. And what is obvious is there are no miracles to be expected from this government. And around 20 out of 24 are linked directly to the political parties and decision maker in the country. So when we're talking about the political reforms, it's going to be quite difficult to reform a country when we have the election coming up next year and the same people are ruling again in the country. So basically, facing the challenges of the daily life needs and the basic daily life needs, like no electricity, no gasoline, and no diesel, the winter is coming, the devaluation of the local currency, there is a free fall of everything in the country. People are migrating from Lebanon and trying to look for better life, or at least a decent life, because it can't be worse for the people in Lebanon who are not used to this kind of life. Ever before, even during the civil war in 1975 and the Israeli war they lived a better life than it is today. So I don't think there are a high expectation. The devaluation of the lira stopped for a few, 24 hours, but I don't think it's going to remain going down and gaining. The Lebanese lira is not going to continue gaining over the dollar because there is no money in the country. And the foreign countries are saying, well, start with your reforms first, and then we can supply you with money or with support, but that is always conditioned. So is it going to privatize everything in the country when people can't afford their daily life and their basic needs? That's going to be a very big challenge for the new government.
Said Mohsen Abbas, a lot of talk about reforms for a new government in Lebanon. What are, in your opinion, the most urgent reforms a future government has to tackle?
Well, I think the most urgent reform is that nations like Lebanon, like Iran, like Syria, those nations which are constantly sanctioned by the United States and by the money mafia around the world, first of all, they need to start thinking about resistance economies rather than constantly relying on the dollar-linked, what I call neoliberal economies. And this has been what the fundamental problem for Lebanon has really been, is that they were tied in by their head of the central bank, Mr. Salame, into the dollar to the extent where, you know, everything is basically beholden to the Americans. And, of course, given the political significance of Lebanon, insofar as Hezbollah and the clash with Israel is concerned, and the broader involvement of the U.S. in the Middle East, of course, then this becomes a playground for certainly what I call the Anglo-Zionist Empire to take hold of. I mean, they don't fundamentally, first of all, want a Lebanon that is strong, unified, and that can stand and resist Israel, for a start. Secondly, they have their own puppets within the country. Of course, there's a large number of politicians and factions around the Hariri camp in particular, which are which would much rather be with Americans and the Saudis, etc. So there is a collision of ideologies as well going on here, political ideologies. But of course, when the whole Salame strategy of tying to the dollar's collapse, what you had was, of course, the impact on the street and the crowds that gathered to try to get the government to move to create ease for them, given all the financial hardships and their lack of access to the dollars that they essentially had tied up in those banks. The Western powers, the Anglo-Zionist empire, it smelled blood, so they fermented even more of those problems at that time. And alongside that strategy of trying to blame Hezbollah for all of this economic crisis, which is clearly what the Americans did at that time, and their proxies inside Lebanon, they also followed through Trump's administration a policy of tightening the economic noose further by making negotiations with the International Monetary Fund the only option for the government to receive any kind of relief, on the condition, of course, that reforms must be first implemented, which they're still, of course, pushing. So, you know, no one questioned the need for deep and structural change in the Lebanese economy, but the IMF's usual fare, as we know, of austerity and privatization, it often results essentially in countries falling deeper into a cycle of debt and dependency. So while they might want to go down the lines that these the international powers are saying to them, that won't necessarily rescue their economy or Lebanon.
Elijah Magnier, in the past, Hezbollah has warned that the U.S. had been responsible for obstructing efforts to form a government. What were Washington's motives in that regard, and will such disruptive efforts continue now?
The U.S. motive at the beginning for the first couple of years since 2019 was to cripple the Lebanese economy and to turn the population against Hezbollah, so they can consider that it is because Hezbollah has weapons, deterrence weapons against Israel, this is the cause of all the troubles of the country. Therefore, Hezbollah needs to be disarmed. What happened is the Lebanese were very much aware that all the friends of the U.S. are the one accused of corruption who ruled the country since 1990. And it is not Hezbollah who is responsible for the corruption and the crisis in the country. Moreover, what happened is that when Hezbollah said, the Hezbollah leader, Said Hassan Nasrallah, said that he's not going to allow the population to starve, and at least the society that protects the party and also the allies of Hezbollah. And this is when the threat has turned into an opportunity, and Hezbollah asked Iran to supply food first, second, medical supply, and a third, the oil tanker. When the U.S. saw that their sanctions are mainly affected their own people, and then Hezbollah and Iran are benefiting from the sanctions imposed on Syria and in consequences on Iran, on Lebanon, then they realize that what they are doing is to fall into the hand of Iran and Hezbollah by reinforcing the Hezbollah-Iran camp in Lebanon and giving another opportunity for the axis of the resistance to use this opportunity and to supply the Lebanese population and to see, to show the Lebanese population the difference between the American and their allies' behavior toward Lebanon and Iran and its allies' behavior toward the population. And this is what turned everything upside down and pushed the U.S. ambassador in Beirut to say, well, wait a minute, we can supply you with gas coming from Egypt. And what happened is today, we have the Americans working very hard to bring the gas from Egypt, and that's going to take 6 to 8 months. On the other hand, the Iranian tankers are not going to stop. So what they have done is they have provided more ammunition, if we can say, and more elements for Iran and Hezbollah to grow their popularity among the population.
Said Mohsen Abbas, when the U.S. warned Beirut about obtaining fuel from Iran, the counteroffer that Washington had, which was importing fuel from Egypt and electricity from Jordan via Syria, which itself is under U.S. sanctions, did that make any sense at all?
Well, Syria is sanctioned from supplying anything, so it doesn't make any sense. But this is the nature of the American imperialist policy in the Middle East. It makes no sense. It makes no sense to the U.S. in terms of its economic prosperity, but it's primarily obviously serving the interests of the wider Israeli Yinon plan in that region, and it's committed to that due to all the Israeli lobbies and their long-standing links. So we all know this, that the U.S. is not really calling the shots on the policy around the Middle East. We know that Tel Aviv and Israel are pushing for anything that happens with its neighbors, and the U.S. Senators and the Congress basically say amen, no matter what that policy is, no matter how diabolically harmful it is to the Americans. So the U.S. economic sanctions, let's just take that as one example of the absolute stupidity, really, of this policy trying to attack Lebanon or even take on the axis of the resistance. You've got, no matter how smart, essentially, Washington claims themselves to be, they rarely, if ever, brought down the targeted regime or group, because that's what they're trying to do in Lebanon. They want to bring down the regime that might have a deference to Hezbollah or supports them, of course, the Christian Maronites, the Amal group, and Hezbollah and others are united in trying to keep the Americans from basically engineering their society and controlling Lebanon. So they're fighting essentially for the independence and sovereignty of Lebanon. But in most recent cases where the U.S. has tried this business of targeted sort of regime change, it's had the opposite effect. And as Elijah was saying earlier, really, it highlights the fact that it simply strengthens the hand of the state that is in power, basically by impoverishing the population and making it more dependent on the government and its support and assistance. So one only has to even look at the 13-year international economic blockade against Iraq and Saddam Hussein when he invaded Kuwait. And there are many, many other examples of this. They've constantly done. But they must really think again and understand that economic sanctions won't work. Military bullying won't work in that region. It's a new West Asia, and if they could only get away from the grip of Israel and actually coordinate a policy of justice and fairness in the region, okay, they might still stand a chance of salvaging some sort of economic link there eventually.
Mr. Abbas, allow me to intervene here, jump in for a second. This is for you as well. Amidst the fuel and energy crisis, how come no Arab country has offered assistance to Lebanon to alleviate some of the pressure that the nation is experiencing right now?
Well, the Arab nations that you talk about are essentially puppet proxies. I mean, we've seen the whole Abraham Accords and the sort of the whole Trump era efforts to essentially normalize Israel, and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have openly done so. The Saudis have also all but done it in name. I mean, they're behind the scenes collaborating, cooperating in every way that you could possibly imagine. So essentially, these Arab governments are ruled by individuals who have been brought to power by the Anglo-Zionist Empire and are maintained by the Anglo-Zionist Empire. They financially support the siphoning of most of the wealth of that region into real estate and other investments and Swiss bank accounts. That's their primary purpose, leaving those countries essentially just as actually, from a manufacturing and from a stability point of view, just as weak as they were before the Anglo-Zionist Empire essentially took over the reins.
Right.
So nothing from them. Those powers will only move if they think that Iran, as it's doing, has a chance of having too much of a hold on Lebanon. Then it's the possibility, as you can see, that they are forced to come in and try and play a brinksmanship game there.
Mr. Magnier, regionally, who benefits from uncertainty and instability in Lebanon?
The Americans and Israel benefit from the instability in Lebanon, because that will turn the attention of the axis of the resistance domestically rather than protecting the borders and preventing Israel from fiddling with the maritime borders and trying to steal the wealth energy of the country. This is something that we've seen also in Syria, which is exactly the same, because the Lebanon has only borders with Syria, and the instability in both countries is essential for what the Americans call the safety of Israel. So this is what they've tried hard in the past in different way, by waging war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, by dividing Syria, and by allowing the Takfiri to rule. Now they try the economic sanction, and this is where they are failing, because as I said, the opportunity came, and the Americans fell into their own trap by removing temporarily the Caesar Act on Syria and allowing it to import the gas from Egypt. So the instability that the U.S. is looking forward to have in Lebanon and Syria is really empowering Syria and Lebanon at the end of the day.
And Mr. Abbas, let's turn our attention to the round after round of U.S. sanctions. These sanctions have been called an act of aggression against all of Lebanon. Why is the United States piling the pressure on the Lebanese people, on all of Lebanon, when the nation is so obviously suffering?
Well, they intended to do it on the actual section of the establishment which was in support of Hezbollah or was actually standing for the sovereignty of Lebanon, as far as I can see. But that has backfired. The fact is that there were, billions of dollars of debt which were there not because of the fault of the Lebanese people, but actually due to the civil war and the money that was injected after the civil war. That money was, let's face it, there was a huge kind of set of corrupt individuals and organizations that have had to essentially divide the pie. Now, that's just a legacy which Lebanon has been left with, but it's been compounded by the IMF and the kind of Americans and all of these forces, which basically want Lebanon to bend its knee to essentially Israel. That's what they're trying to persuade, and they're doing everything in their powers, but it's failing. It seems to me that the axis of resistance has got the upper hand. In Lebanon, I cannot see these economic sanctions working. If the more they the more they do them, the more the population will turn against the Americans and their stooges in Lebanon. And as soon as the stooges find that the heat is coming on them, you'll find that they'll soon start dropping their policies they're trying to roll out there. But the Lebanese people are intelligent people. They will see through most of the situation. I think Hezbollah and Sayyid Nasrallah is playing a very formidable hand in all this, and the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran is there on every level, and I think they're just waiting for the word just as to how much support Lebanon requires. Of course, Lebanon should look east, because beyond Iran there is China, of course there's Russia and the Eurasian axis. This is the game in the Middle East that is going on now, that these nations need to cut free from the slavery imposed by the Anglo-Zionist empire economically, and they need to find new ways of surviving, new economies, resistance economies that are not linked to the Anglo-Zionists.
All right, gentlemen, thank you. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. That was journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels, also journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas speaking to us from the British capital, London. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Researchers say coronavirus is more contagious and more lethal than influenza, and we lack the same global protection mechanism. We have prepared for you an article written by Ian Sample. The piece is titled, Why Living with COVID Would Not Be the Same as Flu. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. England prepares to ease coronavirus restrictions further, the messaging from ministers has changed. They said, it seems we have reached a tipping point in the pandemic where rules will be replaced by personal decisions. The mantra now is about living with coronavirus, much as we do with seasonal flu. The pandemic has invited countless comparisons between coronavirus and influenza, and the diseases do have some features in common. Both are contagious, potentially lethal respiratory viruses. They can spread through aerosols, droplets, and contaminated surfaces. And they share some of the same symptoms in the form of fever, cough, headaches, and fatigue. In the winter ahead, one challenge the NHS staff face is separating the COVID patients from the flu cases. But there are striking differences between coronavirus and flu as well, and these matter very much for public health. Coronavirus spreads faster than influenza and can cause far more serious illness. The symptoms of coronavirus can take longer to show, and people tend to be contagious for longer, making them more prone to passing it on. Seasonal influenza has been around long enough that previous infection and protection from vaccines bear down on cases and deaths. Analysis of previous influenza outbreaks suggests that there are value for seasonal flu. The number of people an infected person passes the virus onto averages about 1.28. This means a group of four people with flu might pass the virus onto five more people. Coronavirus spreads more easily than that. For the Delta variant now surging around the world, R is estimated at about 7. So in the absence of vaccines and other interventions, a single case would infect an average of 7 others. As vaccination programs push on and the virus continues to spread, immunity to coronavirus will drive R down. But how low is a moot point. Coronavirus is more lethal than influenza, largely because vulnerability to the disease rockets in older people. Seasonal influenza killed an estimated 44,505 people in England during the three combined flu seasons from 2015-2016 to 2018-2019. That number died from COVID in England in the first 9 weeks of 2021. A major difference is that the flu figure takes into account the protection of influenza vaccines, where 50% effectiveness is considered good. Coronavirus vaccines should have a greater proportional impact on COVID deaths. So far, the most common COVID vaccines used in the United Kingdom, the Oxford AstraZeneca and the Pfizer-BioNTech shots, reduce the risk of hospitalization from COVID by more than 90%. As a result, the vaccination program has driven COVID deaths down substantially to fewer than 20 a day in the past week. But the vaccines do much more to prevent death than transmission of the virus, so cases of COVID are expected to rise for some time yet. The larger the epidemic grows, the more chance the virus has of finding vulnerable people who have not had their vaccine shots or are not sufficiently protected by the vaccine. While the vaccines dramatically weaken the link between cases and deaths, they are unlikely to break it entirely. The differences between coronavirus, influenza, and the vaccines that target them can easily eclipse a more fundamental issue, though. Learning to live with coronavirus as we live with flu does not mean society can take it in its stride. Every year, a comprehensive global surveillance network detects which variants of influenza are in circulation and most likely to pose a threat in the following season. That information determines which strains go into the annual flu vaccines that are then rolled out in established campaigns. Throughout the flu season, the public health authorities issue case counts and, if needed, update their advice on medical care. There is no such global system for coronavirus as yet. And despite the well-oiled machine that protects the world from flu, the death toll from the virus in a typical year is still substantial. Every winter, flu puts enormous stress on the National Health Service, the NHS, at times pushing it to breaking point. For the health service, living with coronavirus means learning to endure a double wave each winter as coronavirus and flu arrive together. We'll be right back. researchers are working to establish whether the flu jab and a COVID vaccine can be given at the same time as the NHS braces itself for a potential surge in cases of flu this winter. Experts say giving the two shots at the same time could save precious resources for the NHS by avoiding millions of unnecessary appointments. Adam Finn, Professor of Paediatrics at Bristol Medical School and a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, said, "It isn't actually that difficult to give two injections at the same time. We do this in children all the time. But organizing totally different visits has a massive implication in terms of resources and time and so on." According to surveillance data largely encompassing England compiled by the Royal College of GPs, since the start of the pandemic, lockdowns, social distancing and mask wearing have reduced the risk of contracting not only COVID but other respiratory bugs as well, such as the flu, cases of which were basically non-existent last winter. Assuming that many of these measures are lifted in the coming months, a resurgence of flu viruses is expected. Graham Medley, a professor at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who chairs the SAGE subgroup on pandemic modelling, said, "I think we absolutely expect that contact rates will not be as low this coming winter as they were last winter. Restrictions will not be as heavy, and as a result, there will be a flu epidemic." Graham Medley said, "And because of the fact we didn't have one last winter, that might be a bit larger, or a lot larger, and I think that's something that focus will turn to as much as COVID in the future." The ComFluCov study is looking at what side effects people get when they are given a recommended flu vaccine alongside either the Oxford AstraZeneca or the Pfizer BioNTech jab, as well as the immune responses when the two shots are co-administered. Professor Finn said early results on the side effects when the two jabs are given together had been shared with the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization. The study's chief investigator, Dr. Rayeka Lazarus, a consultant in infectious diseases and microbiology at University Hospitals Bristol and Western NHS Foundation Trust, said, "However, the official results are expected by August or September." She said for now, the study is looking at the impact of giving the second COVID dose alongside a flu vaccine, but further research may be needed if a subsequent booster COVID shot is required. Professor Finn said there was a reasonably strong possibility that both the COVID and flu jabs could be administered in one appointment, either this autumn or as part of a program to administer COVID booster shots early next year, or even both. The big question facing researchers on the ComFluCov study is whether the side effects produced by giving both jabs together are worse than when they are given on their own. Another key question is whether the immunity provided by the two jabs changes when they are administered at the same time. Martin Hibbard, a professor of emerging infectious diseases at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, said one concern is that the immune system could respond to one vaccine more than the other, adding, "So you might get a very good response to the COVID vaccine, let's say, but not a very good one to the flu jab, or the other way around. And so that could be a problem." He added, "Alternatively, getting the jabs at the same time might boost the immune response to both." Novavax, the COVID vaccine developer that recently published successful late-stage data on its jab, examined a study that has yet to be peer-reviewed, whether its vaccine could be given in tandem with an influenza vaccine. Data showed that co-administered to jabs resulted in no change to influenza vaccine immune response, while a minor reduction in antibody responses from 89.8% to 87.5% was found for the COVID vaccine. Novavax and Moderna are also in the early stages of developing a combined COVID and flu vaccine.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.